More of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. A little over 2 months ago, people in California's Napa Valley were awakened by a magnitude 6.0 earthquake. It was the largest in the region since the Loma Prieta earthquake in 1989, and one of few recently to have been centered in the wine-growing region specifically.
Lake Effect's wine contributor Ray Pfister paid a visit to Napa recently to learn how the region was faring in the wake of the Temblor. He says there wasn't so much damage to this year's crop of grapes as there was to what was already in the cellars.
A lot of damage with barrels, tanks, that kind of thing. First off, the earthquake took place to the very southern end of Napa Valley, just below the south end of Napa Valley. It was a 6.0, and it was pretty violent. From everybody I talked to, and I talked to a number of people who went through it, one winemaker said she couldn't even get out of bed. It was literally bouncing so violent and so hard she couldn't even get out of her bed. A lot of them said it was more violent than any other quake they've been through. Many quakes tend to have more of this rolling effect. They said it was just hard and nasty. In the southern end of Napa Valley and just below Napa is a city called American Canyon. A lot of warehouses down there, and a lot of those warehouses are housing wine for wineries that can't store it on site. You know, space is a big issue in Napa Valley because, of course, there's a lot of vineyards and there's other kinds of agriculture going on there. So wine is stored in American Canyon in warehouses. That's where their cellars are. You have barrels that are stacked. You have, of course, cases of wine that are already bottled that are stacked. And that's where a lot of damage took place. But in the valley itself, to the southern end of Napa Valley is an area called Carneros. And Carneros is very well known for Pinot Noir and for Chardonnay. Beautiful area. Nice cooler climate. You know, nice amount of fog that comes in and cools the grapes at night. And lots of damage along there. Medina State Winery in particular was one that took a lot of damage. They had some damage in the warehouse, plus the owners live very close by. A lot of damage to their own property. You know, and then in the city of Napa, glass falling off shelves. There was, I believe, 129 structures that were red tagged in the city. So I believe those still have to be inspected and see where they go from here.
What is that likely to do to wine prices and wine availability in the next year?
I'm not so sure at this point about pricing. Total loss as of now is $80 million in the wine industry itself. Of course, beyond that, it's going to be much more for other businesses. As far as pricing, I don't know if it's going to make a huge difference yet. But there are some wineries, boutique wineries, that make 800 cases, 4,000 cases, that kind of thing, who lost their 13 vintage. And to lose an entire vintage means, well, gosh, you're going to go this year without a paycheck. So that's really where the challenge comes in. Beyond that, I think just simply enough, getting some of those wines might be difficult. And 13 was a great vintage. 12, 13, and what looks like 14 is going to be another great vintage. Three in a row is rare. So it's going to be tough for a lot of people.
What about the wines or the grapes that come here for Midwestern wineries to actually produce wine? Are they looking at a lesser amount?
I don't see that being any major issue because from what I'm hearing, there's no major damage in the vines themselves because they're obviously open, nothing falling on them, that kind of thing. I have yet to hear of any actual damage in the vineyards. And harvest hadn't happened yet. It was literally right on the cusp of it. Maybe some whites were being harvested. So, you know, they're in the gondolas, they're being pressed. You know, the whole process really wasn't happening yet. Two really good points. Number one is, you know, yeah, if they were in mid-harvest, just the manpower would have been a real problem because, of course, everybody cleaning up. The other thing, too, it happened at 3:30 in the morning. If that was 3:30 in the afternoon just before harvest, there would have been a lot of people killed, barrels falling on them. I mean, all kinds of terrible things. One of the other problems they ran into simply was storage space. As they approach harvest, because they were still working on cleaning up their spaces, people just had nowhere to put things. This is something people don't realize in a winery, and having the opportunity a couple times to work in one, space is a big deal. You know, again, when you've got farming property out there, the barns and the storage areas are actually not that big. So you have to move things around to make them efficient. That's why probably the number one piece, you won't see as much tractors out there as you will see forklifts. Moving things around, getting things jammed in exactly where they belong. When you have damage like this, you have nowhere to put things. So a lot of people were running quickly trying to find other storage spaces or simply enough get a hold of barrels to replace the barrels that were damaged. One example is I was talking to a winemaker about when the barrels had fallen. These are heavy. Barrel empty is heavy. So they have to basically pump the juice out of the barrel into another barrel and then remove them one at a time from basically what has been a like building blocks falling down. you have to have somewhere to put that.
Does the wine that has been in the barrel that fell, is that salvageable, or is that basically just going on to the slop pile?
If the barrel wasn't broken, yeah, the wine's fine.
Okay.
If the barrel's open, chances are, no, they're not going to be able to save it because right. once it's exposed to air, you know, then it's going to go bad on you.
But shaking it up is not an issue?
Generally speaking, no.
All right.
You know, in fact, more often that's what you do.
You want to, but it's controlled, Ray.
Right,
it's
exactly.
It's control shaking. It's not – you don't want to call in the earthquakes.
Yeah, this is about as much uncontrolled shaking as
yes.
you can. So, and a lot of people were comparing it to the previous quake, which I believe was 6 or 7 years ago, which was a 5-something, just saying it was – there were two different characters. In fact, the scariest thing I heard, to be quite frank, was a winemaker I knew who grabbed his kids and got them out into a, you know, the under the hallway, that kind of thing, to keep them safe. And the first thing he thought was, oh, my God, San Francisco's gone.
Really? That bad?
Well, they just didn't realize they were at the epicenter because they don't get them there that often. If you live close to a place that's sort of the, you know, the target for earthquakes, that's the first thing you'd think. And, of course, people in San Francisco felt it. People in Oakland evidently didn't, from what I heard.
Interesting. Interesting. Having lived in that area, it is interesting. You think of the Bay Area sort of all squished together, but it really is a lot of separate areas and on different parts of the plates.
It is. And
yeah.
there's a couple of other plates that are out there. I believe there was a newly discovered one fairly recently. So from what I heard, from what I was told, one of my friends who works for one of the major wineries out there was telling me that they've been able to get a lot of information from what came of this quake that's helped them with research. I'll give you one example. I stayed in the city of Napa with a winemaker friend of mine, and I woke up one morning and I heard what sounded like gunshots. Well, you don't hear gunshots in Napa, and they were sporadic for probably about 15 minutes. This is a byproduct of the quake. These are little like gases being released from the earth that are just simply popping off. And this is something they really didn't have a lot of information on. Now, they've set up cameras in key areas, and they're monitoring some of these after effects, and they're learning more information than they ever have on a quake.
Well, let's get back to wine. And you mentioned that 13 was a great year, 12 was a great year, and 14 is looking like it's going to be a great year too. What are you excited to drink from those vintages?
Well, see, I'm kind of funny. I like 2011 myself too. 2011, I remember it very well because I worked at a winery for a week that year. It was wet. It was rainy. It was a difficult vintage. Everybody was trying to get their grapes off the vines before the rains came. Rains come. Grapes get moldy. You don't want to let this happen. And you have to dry them before they come off the vines. A lot of winemakers took that as a challenge to really make sure that they created a great wine. I've tried several 11s, and I think they're as good as any wine I've tasted. What's disappointing is some of the major trade magazines have really dissed the 11 vintage. It seems almost like a carpet bombing of the vintage, which I don't think is fair. 12 was a vintage, as the winemakers will tell you. They could have all gone on vacation. The wine would make itself. It was just a matter of not screwing up in the cellar. And in the end, any winemaker will tell you great wine is made in the vineyards. So 13, 14, great optimal growing years. So as far as what I like to drink, I'm liking 12 a lot. That's been the most exciting one. The others really aren't ready for drinking just yet, so we'll see what comes of it.
So of the 12, red, white, what are you looking at?
Oh, I'm kind of a red guy, but you know, I've learned to open my mind. If there's any advice I can give to anybody out there drinking wine is I never used to be a big white drinker. Now I love Sauvignon Blanc, a Pinot Gris, all kinds of different whites.
I'm fond of Pinot Grigio, too.
Pinot Gris, Pinot Grigio, same thing.
Is it the same thing?
It is the same thing, right. Just different areas it comes from in terms of its name. I am a red guy, though. I'm a Cabernet guy. I love the big, you know, chewy reds.
Big, bold reds.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. But I would never touch a dessert wine years ago, and now I do. Ports, I really enjoy that. It's how you look at them when you drink them, and I advise people to try them at every opportunity. Again, it's the kind of thing you'd have after a dinner, and you have a small amount of it, and you just – it's like a good bourbon. You sip it. You don't – obviously, you're not going to gulp it down. But enjoy the full-bodied taste that you have in something like this. And there's so many great dessert wines that are made not just in Napa but, you know, here in Wisconsin and ice vines, that kind of thing. They're really tasty, but it's just a matter of don't judge them. Try them first and then have an opinion. That's all it really
comes
down to.
Well, and proportion too. You're not going to have a big, large red glass wine full of it.
That would be a challenge.
Yes. And we might be having our own earthquakes here if we were doing
I wouldn't
that.
Want to be around after all that.
No, me either. But Ray Pfister, it is great to have you back in the studio, and I look forward to continuing our conversations in the months ahead.
Thanks, Bonnie. Look forward to it as well.
Our wine contributor, Ray Pfister, runs the wine blog and podcast, Life Between the Vines. He also owns Fifth Floor Recording in Milwaukee's Third Ward.
One last break, and then why it is important to find the right partner if you're trying to find your creative spark. This is Lake Effect from WUWM.